listening to CPR, communitypublicradio.org. And this is Weekday World. I'm your host, Don DeBar. With a report of some of the news and events of the past 24 hours from the CPR Newsroom. From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Another showdown at the United Nations Security Council on Wednesday over the so-called Skripal poisoning case in Salisbury in the UK. Wednesday's session began with a report from Izumi Nakamitsu, the High Representative for Disarmament Affairs at the UN, who summarized new information about the March 4th incident in Salisbury, which she had received from the Organization for the Prevention of Chemical Weapons, or OPCW. Blood samples taken from the victims, including the Russian nationals Sergei Skripal and his daughter Yulia, and from the environment at the site, confirmed the UK's findings regarding the identity of the toxic chemicals. However, it was emphasized that OPCW had assigned no responsibility for the incident and cautioned against casting blame without evidence. This was the High Representative for Disarmament Affairs, Izumi Nakamitsu, at the UN Security Council Wednesday.
Thank you for the invitation to brief you on the incident in Salisbury in the United Kingdom on 4th of March 2018. As I have no independent information on this issue, I will be conveying information kindly provided by the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons, or OPCW. Mr. President, the Council has met previously to discuss the 4th of March incident in Salisbury involving a toxic chemical, allegedly a nerve agent, and the poisoning and hospitalization of three individuals as a result. As you are therefore aware, and as part of its response to this incident, the United Kingdom requested technical assistance from the OPCW Technical Secretariat under Article 8 of the Chemical Weapons Convention. This article states that the OPCW Secretariat shall provide technical assistance and technical evaluation to states parties in the implementation of the provisions of the Convention including evaluation of scheduled and unscheduled chemicals. Accordingly, the OPCW Director General decided to dispatch a team to the United Kingdom for a technical assistance visit, or TAV. The TAV team deployed to the United Kingdom on 19th March for a pre-deployment and from 21 to 23 March for a full deployment. In the course of its work, the team received information on the medical conditions of the three individuals affected and collected blood samples from those individuals under full chain of custody for delivery to the OPCW laboratory and subsequent analysis by OPCW-designated laboratories. In addition to these activities, the TAV team conducted on-site sampling of environmental samples, again under full chain of custody. The team also requested and received splits of samples taken by British authorities for comparative purposes and to verify the analysis of the United Kingdom. The team was briefed on the toxic chemical that had been identified by the United Kingdom and reviewed analytical results and data from chemical analysis of biomedical samples collected by United Kingdom authorities from the affected individuals, as well as from environmental samples collected on site. The OPCW has since stated that the results of analysis of biomedical samples conducted by OPCW-designated laboratories demonstrate the exposure of the three affected individuals to this toxic chemical. In addition, the results of analysis of the environmental samples conducted by OPCW-designated laboratories demonstrated the presence of this toxic chemical in the samples. Finally, the results of analysis by the OPCW-designated laboratories of environmental and biomedical samples collected by the OPCW TAV team confirmed the findings of the United Kingdom relating to the identity of the toxic chemical that was used on 4th of March in Salisbury. The TAV team has noted that the toxic chemicals in question was of high purity. Mr. President, based on the results of the sample analysis by four OPCW-designated laboratories, the OPCW Technical Secretariat prepared a report containing and elaborating on the information I just shared. This report was transmitted to the United Kingdom and, upon the request of the United Kingdom, to all other states parties of the CWC on 12th of April. The OPCW has also prepared and made publicly available a summary of this report. Speaking today at a meeting of the OPCW Executive Council, the Director General underscored that the reliability and technical capabilities of the OPCW designated laboratories have been subject to close and rigorous scrutiny over the years. He added that states parties to the Chemical Weapons Convention can be assured of the credibility and integrity of this network. He further noted that the work of the TAV in relation to this incident was carried out independently by the OPCW without involvement or support of other states' parties and that it was not part of the United Kingdom's own internal investigation. Mr. President, distinguished members of the Council, the Secretary General has expressed his deep concern by the assessment that a nerve agent was employed in a targeted manner aimed at inflicting harm or death. The Secretary General has also, on many occasions, expressed his support for the work of the OPCW. In this regard, he welcomed the request by the United Kingdom to independently verify the toxic chemical that was used in this incident. the use of nerve agents or any other chemical weapons by any party under any circumstances is unacceptable and a serious violation of international law. I thank you very much for your attention.
That report from the High Representative for Disarmament Affairs of the UN, Izumi Nakamitsu, was followed by comments from the Permanent Representative of the UK, who said the report supported her own government's findings that a nerve agent had been identified, and that although the report had not identified the country nor laboratory of origin, only Russia had the means, technical experience, and motive to target the Skripals. Russia's permanent representative, Vasily Nebenzia, rejected those allegations, emphasizing that the OPCW report revealed the toxic substances could have been produced in the Russian Federation, the United States, or a host of other countries. This was Ambassador Nebenzia at the UN Security Council on Wednesday.
Thank you, Mr. President. Today, we heard the same selection of baseless accusations, now underpinned allegedly by the authority of the OPCW. I will state right away that the OPCW report has nothing that would help the British to substantiate their mendacious version about Russian involvement into the incident in Salisbury. What is most important that is not included there, and which the United Kingdom is so keen to see, is the conclusion that the substance used in Salisbury was made in Russia. On the contrary, the promptness of the analysis conducted by the OPCW only confirms that such a substance could be produced in any laboratory equipped with the relevant equipment. For to conduct a comparative analysis, is necessary to have a standard for this toxic compound. And there are such laboratories, both on UK soil, in Portland Down, and in the United States, and in a host of other countries. The formula for the substance has been known from 1998, when it was incorporated in the database of the U.S. Army Edgewood Chemical Biological Center. Center for Defense Research and Equipment of the U.S. Army and Development. Moreover, as a result of following a search on Google Patents, looking at the keyword Novichok, one can find more than 140 patents issued in the U.S. alone related to the use and protection from exposure of this toxic chemical. From the incident in Salisbury on 4 March, a month and 2 weeks have already passed. However, in this history, this is a story with white stains that is threaded together with white thread, and there is no lessening in such white stains and thread. On the contrary, they are proliferating with stunning speed. For us, such conduct by London is not transparent. Today, during the Executive Council of the OPCW session, a UK representative, whose statement, as is customary, was based on lies and misinformation as to the motivations, methods, and uses by the Russian means by the Russian Federation, once again stated that Russia has a proven record of conducting state-sponsored assassination. My question is as follows. Proven by whom? Of course, there were subsequent abundant references to the Litvinenko case with arguments on the basis of a new word in British jurisprudence. President Putin probably approved of it.
The Russian state may have been involved. The Russian state may have sponsored. There have been numerous suspected Russian state-sponsored attacks.
Ladies and gentlemen, everything that we are hearing and seeing today is déjà vu. We have already experienced this with the poisoning of Litvinenko in that case, complete lack of transparency by the British side, which continues to conceal any and all documentary information that could help to put together an integral picture of what took place at that point with the Vienko. For those who are unaware, I will inform you, the United Kingdom has simply classified this information. Nor for this modus operandi of London, nor was an exception the report from the Technical Assistance OPCW Group dating 12 April. In the open part of this document, which is 1.5 pages, in the open part, the British barred experts of the organization from even mentioning, not only mentioning the type of technical assistance that was requested, but even from naming the toxic chemical that Portland Down identified. This is all information which London preferred to conceal in the close, in the confidential part of the report, the discussions of which in an open format of a council meeting would constitute a breach of the OPCW's rules of confidentiality. For what purpose was this done? That is clear to us. Well, if a British fails to grant the right for members of council to discuss what they took the liberty of including in the substantive part of the report, then let us discuss what is not included there. What is not included there, above all, is any mention of the Russian Federation. And this aligns with the conclusions we previously heard from Portland Down. There is not the slightest indication of any information as to the fact that Sergei and Yulia Skripal were contaminated, nor about Nicholas Bailey. Nor is there any information about the history of their illness, nor is there any information on the methods for their treatment. You won't find any explanation there as to how the toxic chemical, which, according to the alleged creator of it, Vladimir Zayanov, is highly unstable in liquid form, could be discovered in high concentration nearly 3 weeks after the incident. Nor is there any mention there as to why this substance is allegedly 10 times more deadly than VX. This substance could have an impact on some victims after 7 hours pass and other victims instantaneously. And why then? Thank God, the effects were not deadly. Perhaps Mirzayanov and Portland Down are talking about different toxic chemicals. Moreover, you will not find in this report any coherent explanation as to how, in the blood samples of one of the patients taken 18 days after contact, an undecayed toxic chemical was not discovered, established by Portland Down, and the other victim who received a more potent contamination, with that victim we did not see the same. This picture is not only characteristic for nerve agents, but it also may indirectly point to the fact that with high likelihood, it is highly likely that prior to the collecting of samples of the toxic chemical in Portland Down, the blood of the victim was injected prior to when he entered an artificial coma, in connection with which there was no time for him to enter engage in a biochemical reaction. As a result, an important question begs to be asked. 5 April, the permanent representative of the United Kingdom, when I quoted Boris Johnson with respect to the presence of samples in Portland Down of A234, responded, alleging that the United Kingdom has the right to conduct an investigation for protective purposes. Perhaps distinguished Portland Down experts researched and have this and other toxic chemicals which are not included in the relevant OPCW lists. I believe that in preparing reports of the Scientific and Consultative Council of the Technical Secretariat of the OPCW for the fourth review conference of the Chemical Weapons Convention, that would be the time, high time, for the Portland Down experts to provide the scientific world with information about their research into A234 for protective purposes and possibly other toxic chemicals which pose a threat to the purposes and principles of the convention. But let's not harbor illusions. The conduct selected by the United Kingdom for the Salisbury incident clearly points to the fact that this will not be done. In a professional discussion, the UK and allies are not at all interested in conducting a professional discussion, and professional chemists and experts continue to cast doubt as time goes by as to the official version provided by the British. Mr. President, unfortunately, a subjective interpretation by London of the provisions of the OPCW cannot but give rise to questions. For example, the British consistently refers to the fact that its national investigation is ongoing in line with Para 1 of Article 7 of the Convention. The justification of such a reference would be proper if not one but. Such an investigation pertains solely to physical and legal individuals which are under United Kingdom jurisdiction. I believe it should be perhaps clarified that Russia is not under UK jurisdiction, and this goes without saying. Hence, we would request that the United Kingdom introduce some clarity. Downing Street's statements about alleged Russian involvement in the incident in Salisbury is an attempt to exert political pressure on the investigation, or is it a final conclusions of Scotland Yard's investigation, or is this normal under the British legal system for the government to identify perpetrators and subsequently the investigative bodies to tailor their investigation to fit that conclusion? Once again, I stress, any doubts vis-a-vis in good faith compliance by a state party with obligations of the convention need to be settled in line with Article 9. And what they must. There is no other meaning for the word shall or should. They shall or should, and we know of no other definition for the word. We would be grateful for those with English as a mother tongue to provide clarification as to when such words will not be mandatory in nature, and would be very constructive. This would be very constructive for further practical work here at the Council. Given that our repeated proposals to London to begin to cooperate and engage under Article 9 have been ignored, and the request of the Russian Federation's Prosecutor General to provide legal assistance on criminal affairs in line with Para 2 of Article 7 have been left without response, we have no other choice but ourselves to initiate a request under Para 2 of Article 9 with a list of questions for the United Kingdom on the 4 March incident in Salisbury. The relevant note was submitted on 13 April by the U.S. Permanent Mission in The Hague to the British through the OPCW Technical Secretariat. In connection with the above mentioned, in light of the above mentioned, we believe that the General Director of the Technical Secretariat of the OPCW to adopt measures to reinforce the Chemical Weapons Convention needs to prepare for and introduce for the next Executive Council meeting in line with Para 5 of the relevant convention a draft resolution providing for amendments to the chemicals annexed to the list. This decision would not only lead to an official classification of A234 as a chemical warfare agent, but it would also take it and its precursors and put it under the systematic oversight and control of the OPCW. This is what should have long ago been done by those countries who apparently had all of the relevant information for this, including samples of this toxic chemical, and not to exploit the OPCW and Security Council to disseminate their groundless allegations against the Russian Federation in allegations of breaching obligations under the Chemical Weapons Convention. Mr. President, it is no secret the information campaign and actually the war that has been unleashed by the British authorities against the Russian Federation on the so-called Skripal case. The norms of international law are being flouted. The rules are being flouted. The principles and laws of diplomacy are being breached. Good Common sense is being disregarded. Basic courtesies are being undermined. Against the backdrop of deafening silence by British competent authorities on the essence of the case and the abundant politically hued statements from the very beginning which were targeted against Russia, new versions continue to surface. Major deafening inconsistencies are surfacing. There are plantings and blatant misinformation, which London does not intend to refute in any way. We see the red herring. And now there is a calculation that the cacophony with baseless accusations and references to distinguished organizations as the OPCW, which allegedly fully confirmed the British conclusions, and then it is not said what is said as to Russian involvement. Once again, I state that this is a complete lie. States and societies will not ascertain the nuances of chemical analysis and the numerous inconsistencies in the accusations that have been advanced. As Churchill said, there is no public opinion. There is only published opinion. And the British and allies have no problems with disseminating their mendacious allegations and smearing them over the media outlets. The British put two questions to us. We put 47 questions to the British. Here they are. Partial responses were provided for two of them. There are no responses to those questions which we put during the previous Security Council meeting on this issue held 5 April. We will have more questions. We promised that we will not step away from this. We will continue. In order to familiarize ourselves with a scientific and factual side of this, we will familiarize you with a statement of Russian representatives during the 59th session of the OPCW, as well as the chronology of the sequence events which was put together by our embassy in London. At the same time, we will circulate this statement as well. And this, at the same time, the British authorities are quietly seeking to eliminate any traces of evidence and material evidence or proof. The household pets have been destroyed from their home. Clearly, there were no samples taken from them. The places are being cleared. The places visited by Skripals, a bar, restaurant, a bench, and the park area where they were, and other areas. And at the same time, ordinary civilians continue to reside in Salisbury as if nothing took place. Yulia Skripal her whereabouts are unknown. There is no consular access being provided for a Russian citizen. Let me recall that neither Julia nor Sergei has been seen by anybody since 4 March. At the same time, against Russian citizens, a crime was perpetrated. There was an attempted murder with indicators that this may have been a terrorist in nature. I wish once again to reaffirm our position in principle. We will not accept the results of any national or international investigations without familiarizing ourselves with the whole body of information, be it information from the criminal investigation or full technical reports from the laboratories, without exercise of our right to consular access to Russian citizens, and most importantly, without direct participation of Russian experts in all operations related to shedding light on what took place 4 March in Salisbury. And the only thing that is clear to us right now is that London continues to conceal information, which is critical to establish the truth, and it will not accept any degree of transparency in this matter. Once again, the British Embassy distinguished itself in Moscow recently. It put forward the following sensational information. Approximately the same was put forward by the UK representative at the OPCW and the permanent representative of the United Kingdom to the United Nations in today's letter to the Secretary General first. In the past 10 years, Russia has produced and stockpiled Novichok. Second, Russia conducted an investigation on the use of chemical warfare agents for murders. Third, Russian intelligence beginning in 2013 has focused its interest on Sergei Skripal. This is genius. I applaud you. The question is as follows. Why is this all necessary? And the responses are banal in their clarity. This is an attempt to slander Russia in principle and to cast doubt on its legitimacy and its role on the international stage. I said not for naught that Salisbury and Duma are interrelated, firstly, due to the fact that both are provocations. Second, due to the fact that both are being linked to Russia. This is an unscrupulous, dirty anti-Russian provocation aimed at deepening the divide between Russia and the European Union, which apparently is especially timely for the UK on the eve of Brexit. And that is the substance of the matter. To conclude, Mr. President, apparently the time has arrived to delve into classics. To William, of course, our Shakespeare, who in Henry VI, the play, said, "Suspicion always haunts the guilty mind." But perhaps we should attempt to package up the suspicions nicely. Otherwise, it is not convincing, and honestly, we feel bad for you. We will eagerly await the continuation of this very interesting series. If the British drags its feet with new information, or providing new information, or with such sensation in the spirit of what was referred to, then we ourselves reserve the right to call such a meeting. Do not think that you can hide behind poisonous falsification of your lies and conjecture. The technical assistance OPCW mission is not, we're not done with the technical mission of the OPCW. We will continue to demand the full picture of the facts. Of course, there's chemistry in this whole issue, from the word being sly and cunning. So in Russian, chemichit is the word. Chemistry is chemia, chemichit. And you did dig yourselves this hole, and it's quite good. We see how cunning you are. We agree with you on one point. There will be no impunity. And the perpetrators for this provocation must be held accountable. Thank you.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.
Hello and welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. U.S. President Donald Trump says he wants American troops to leave Syria. The foreign policy blob surrounding him says differently. So what are exactly Washington's goals in Syria? Partition? War for war's sake? Or a means to sticking it to Iran and Russia? All are poorly thought out options. Crosstalking Syria, I'm joined by my guest, Gareth Porter in Washington. He's an independent investigative journalist and historian, as well as author of Manufactured Crisis, The Untold Story of the Iran Nuclear Scare. In London, we have Danny Mackey. He is a Syria commentator and co-founder of Syrian Digital Media Group. And in Doha, we cross the Mohammed Shirkawi. He is a professor of conflict resolution at George Mason University and author of What is Enlightenment, Continuity or Rupture in the Wake of the Arab Uprisings. All right, gentlemen, crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump in anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. Danny, let me go to you, because I know you just came back from Syria, so you have a good feel for the lay of the land here. You know, I asked in my introduction just exactly what do you think Washington's goals are, because I guess it depends on who you ask in Washington these days. Go ahead, Danny.
Absolutely. I mean, Washington has really had nothing of a coherent strategic policy in Syria for many years. It's not just now. I mean, we've had 4 or 5 years of Washington saying they'd want to take the lead from behind and not really understanding exactly where it's going with its strategy. And this has been really, really shown by the last events of over 100 US Tomahawk missiles striking different Syrian military targets while I was in Damascus, for that matter. And at the end of the day, 3 or 4 hours later, you've got pro-Assad protests within Syria and jubilation on the streets because they know Washington will not achieve their policy of regime change and that this is purely a symbolic slash limited strike on different military targets. But it doesn't come with a package. There is no package at the moment. There is no clear consensus over what the US wants to do in Syria. It's just bits and pieces. And but if you read between the lines, what you've got is an administration where you sense a lot of people want to leave Syria. Trump really doesn't know what he wants,
yep.
And it's all up in the air. And if I was America's allies at the moment in the region, especially Saudi Arabia, I would be very worried over what the U.S. wants to do in Syria.
You know, Gareth, you know, maybe this is by design because there is no real reason for the United States to be in Syria. Actually, it is there illegally under international law. I also said in my introduction, is this just a means, a policy wedge, a tool to stick it to Iran and the Russians?
Well, at one level, you could say that it's all of the above because there are people within the national security bureaucracy who hold those goals. But at the same time, you know, there has been, as Danny just said, no coherent strategy. There's been no agreement on what U.S. Policy should be, what U.S. strategy should be for many years. And you know, beginning with the original decision to intervene on behalf of the armed opposition to Assad back in 2011, when the president himself, when President Obama knew very well that he didn't really want to do it, he felt that this was getting into another sort of Afghanistan-type intervention, which could not turn out well. He made that argument, we know, repeatedly over the next couple of years. And at the same time, you had Hillary Clinton and David Petraeus and others in his administration pushing for a much more aggressive policy. That's been the pattern now for years. Now, today you have Trump, everyone knows, really expressing repeatedly the desire to get out of Syria and to have a very strict time limit on the war against ISIS. And the military saying, no, we can't do that. And others in the administration clearly not in sympathy with it, and so there's a kind of uncertainty about how that's going to play out. But if you look at it in the larger picture of geopolitics, you know that basically the President of the United States and the President of Russia are both not interested in having a war continue in Syria, and I think that ultimately is going to play a big role in how this plays out in the next year.
You know, let's see how this plays out. Mohammed, let me go to you in Doha. It seems to me one of the reasons why the U.S. is staying there, first of all, it doesn't like the current condition, and it wants to be a power broker. It wants to be part of some kind of settlement, and it wants to make sure it's a settlement that it wants. So it's still kind of hedging its bets for regime change. I'm sure that there's pressure from the Saudis and the Israelis to stay there as well. But it all ties together is that it is really incoherent, and we have these situations where we have these false, as far as I'm concerned, it was a false flag operation, this chemical weapons attack. I mean, I guess a lot of the regional players have to be very worried about what the U.S. is going to do because it doesn't know what it wants to do. Go ahead in Doha.
Well, apparently there have been mixed signals coming from the White House in particular, and I think there is no disagreement that President Trump lacks a coherent strategy or an after-attack plan, how to sustain the presence or how to sustain the impact of the U.S. foreign policy in the Middle East. Across the region, the recent attacks in Homs and in Damascus have been ridiculed because he raised the expectations very high by condemning the red light, the red line of his predecessor, Barack Obama, in 2013. So far, I think Trump has entrapped himself in the very same position like Obama, and his lack of effectiveness on the field has turned the United States into a joke now. And I think now the Iranians are smiling, the Saudis are bewildered, and also most of the governments here are asking what's next. And I think this is a $64,000 question.
Yes, and I will add one more perplexity to all this, Danny, is Turkey. Okay, the U.S., it won't cut the Kurds loose. This drives the Turks mad. Okay, and I've said repeatedly, the Turks are in Syria illegally under international law. However, I do understand their concern. I can see from their position about their security issues vis-a-vis the Kurds. I understand it. I don't necessarily agree with it. But really is what at stake here. Not only is there ambiguity coming from Washington, there is a very serious danger to NATO unity. And, you know, it is being played out on the ground. And I, you know, talking about red lines, I don't see the Turks backing down at all. Go ahead, Danny.
The Turks won't back down, and that's for one primary reason. They believe that they have some sort of historic right to the north of Syria, and they've been led that way through the actions of the United States of America. If you look at the situation now between Turkey and the Kurds and Turkey in northern Syria, you've got the start of another very, very, very long war. I don't think that this will end anytime soon. And what the US has got out of all of this is actually that it's a very weak ally. The moment one of its allies faces a problem or faces danger, the US just ups and leaves and pretends like nothing has happened. And the Kurds have only gone to the Russians and gone to Assad because they feel that the US has betrayed them, because the US just left them. They allowed Turkey to literally eat up all of this Kurdish territory in the north of Syria. Now, what we're seeing in the whole country, which is very different to how the previous situation was, is it's a war of peripheries now. If you look at it, the only areas where there's conflict and there's tension is border areas, you know, between Syria and Turkey, Syria and Iraq, Syria and Lebanon, Syria and Jordan. The center of the country has been retaken because of the Russian intervention in 2015, and now we go back to that huge intervention. Without Russia intervening, we wouldn't have this situation today. And the US are only acting out of envy because they want to be in Russia's position. You know, Russia today, over the previous weeks has brokered a number of agreements for rebels to leave areas around Damascus and Qalamun, while the US is looking onwards, you know, striking one or two military targets in a very vague attack, which ultimately didn't really, Syria had chemical weapons ability, those strikes would not have affected it, because Trump essentially gave them a week's notice by posting it on Twitter. So this is the way the US is running its wars these days, by Trump's tweets.
And this is something he said he would never, ever do. One of his first press conferences, he said, I will never tell you what I'm going to do. And then he telegraphs it. But Gareth, he did that on purpose because he knows he's painted himself into a corner, and his advisors are making sure that he doesn't have any maneuver room. So that's why you throw these missiles at them. I've heard a dozen different versions about how many of them made their target, how many of them were shot down, how many of them didn't work, okay? I don't know, okay? But the American version doesn't stand up to much scrutiny from what I can tell. Go ahead, Gareth. It was just political theater. It wasn't actually a military strike. It was political theater. Gareth.
I couldn't agree more on that point. And you know, if you actually read the morning briefing that was given at the Pentagon after the night that the strikes took place, it was an amazing performance in the sense that you know, the people doing the briefing absolutely would not answer questions that had to do with, for example, did you actually do any air sampling to find out if, you know, when you hit this supposed place where they were making chemical weapons, there was any problem affecting the air of the people surrounding it. And it's clear that they hadn't done it and that they couldn't basically say what the consequences were of the target they hit. And I think that what that means is that they really didn't have any information that was a place where they were producing this kind of chemicals.
Let me jump in here. We've got to go to a hard break, and after that hard break, we'll continue our discussion on Sirius. Stay with RT.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Okay, let me go back to Mohammed in Doha. Nikki Haley, she says she's not confused. I think she's confused all of the time. She made it very clear that the U.S. presence in Syria is aimed at Iran. She was very clear about that. Of course, people in the White House didn't like her saying it, but she said she's not confused, okay? Is this really what it's really all about? Is it because of the political situation, the status quo in Syria, where other actors are creating political facts, and the U.S. is just occupying? Are they really turning in a different direction? Is this really what it's all about, is focusing in on Iran?
Well, I think that Nikki Haley is not the only U.S. official in the Trump administration who is confused or doesn't know how to paraphrase the intentions of Trump. And I think now we are at a situation that is a combination of performative politics a la Trumpism, if we can say it that way, and also a piecemeal tactics. Whenever Trump runs into problems, he has to figure out this theatrics of politics in front of cameras. Yep. The difference between what is said in front of cameras and what is done or executed in the field, in particular in Syria, is huge. And I think now we have been talking about the rise of anti-Americanism. I think now we have to pay attention to something new, is the waning confidence in Washington by Middle Easterners. And now it becomes like this great power that has lost its focus. And also probably Trump has put so much on his plate that he can handle now. We have the future escalation next month with Iran and the nuclear deal. We have the upcoming summit with the North Korean leader. So much to deal with. And I think now Trump has probably lowered his, you know, the expectations of the public here in this region of the world by embracing so many adventures. And then he cannot deliver much. What I remain concerned about is if Trump and the Kremlin loses their grip on both the Iranians on the one hand and the Israelis on the other hand, that's when it's going to be a messy joke. And I don't think that Trump will be able to figure out what to do next.
You know, I think Mohammed brought up a really good point, because there's so many festering issues, particularly in the Middle East, but on a broader scale with North Korea. The U.S. doesn't have a grasp on the situation. I mean, one of the things I have noticed with this administration is that there's so many war hawks, so many military people, and then you have Pompeo coming in, not exactly a man of great tact, okay, and diplomacy. Mm. And what we really need now, and I mean this for all players, because my primary issue is peace and having peace settlements, okay? You're going to need a lot of finesse. You're going to need a lot of patience. Mm. And to date, this administration doesn't exhibit any of the above. Go ahead, Danny.
Well, I would just like to bring you back to the moment when the initial disagreement between the Russians and Trump started, and Trump issued the tweet, and the response of the Russian Foreign Ministry was that we don't participate in Twitter diplomacy. Now, you can bring this back here because the main problem is the policy. It's not just the people. You need finesse. You need that class of managing to find agreements. Obama managed to do it with the Iranians, for sure. But the Americans don't have a policy. That's the problem. You've got Trump, who's just discussing leaving Syria. And then within the next couple of days, he sets another red line. And then he begins to make threats of attacking Syria after an alleged chemical weapons attack, which wasn't verified internationally. And he chose to strike Syria on the same day that the UN chemical weapons inspectors arrived to actually investigate the scene. Yeah. So from that perspective, you've got a leader who's acting in a very confusing way, who's misleading himself, his administration, and his allies, and who essentially doesn't know what to do in Syria longer than this week.
Yep.
So what Syria needs at the moment is an international agreement to be reached. But is Trump the person to deliver that agreement, that consensus? Absolutely not. And if I was sat in Moscow's position now, I would be very wary of having to negotiate or deal with Trump on any matter, not just Syria for that matter, because in Trump you're dealing with an individual who is so unpredictable, who has such a lack of understanding of the situation, that all you have to do is bring up his tweets from 2013 ridiculing Obama for who didn't act in Syria, to understand that the guy has completely gone against every one of his statements. I mean, as one of the commentators said, you know, there's a Trump tweet for every occasion. So if you look at the situation now,
I wish that weren't funny, but it is. Okay, I shouldn't laugh because it's such a situations of great gravity here. Let me go to Gareth here, because, you know, both Mohammed and Danny bring up really good points here. I mean, next month, I guess we're all anticipating it, that Trump's going to withdraw from the Iran deal, okay? And at the same time, he wants to make a deal with the North Koreans. I mean, and then the U.S. is stubborn, and actually it works as a negative force in Syria that doesn't allow a peace process to move forward. Anytime peace could possibly break out in Syria, well, Ash Carter comes around and bombs, okay? Or just when a major city is liberated from terrorists and supported by foreigners, oh, we have a chemical weapons attack here. So, I mean, on every single scale, there's no reason to be optimistic here. And one does influence the other. These situations are interconnected. Go ahead, Gareth.
Well, of course, they are interconnected in the sense that the North Koreans are constantly looking at what the United States is doing elsewhere in the world to assess, you know, how to deal with them in terms of trying to negotiate a settlement, which they've been trying to do for three generations of the Kim family.
Yes.
And so that is entirely that's centrally important to their calculations. And I think that it's very important to understand that Kim Jong-un does indeed intend to bring about a comprehensive solution with Trump, if it's at all possible. And that this has happened primarily, I would argue, because of President Moon of South Korea's patient diplomacy with the North and with Trump. And clearly, Moon has been very clever in appealing to Trump's sense of vanity, making it possible for Trump to say, I am the one who's made this possible, and it couldn't have happened without me. As long as Moon is able to carry on that diplomacy with Trump, I do have some hope for these talks really succeeding. But of course, we have John Bolton whispering in Trump's ear, trying to convince him to do something different. And that is the fly in the ointment, to say the least. But definitely, I think that Trump is now moving in the direction that is hopeful on peace with North Korea. And that is quite an astonishing turn of events, even more astonishing, I must say, than Nixon going to China.
Yeah, you know, let me go back to Doha. Mohammed, one of the things I think is very interesting, I mean, we had the North Korean leader visit Beijing recently. We had Pompeo, State Department designate head, meeting with the leadership of North Korea. I get this strong feeling, and I don't see Western analysts looking at it this way. The trip to China wasn't begging. It was, I've got an idea, and do you back it? And I think it's going to be, and this is going to be the true test of leadership, is that denuclearization, yes, America must withdraw its military completely from the peninsula. That is actually a good idea with Chinese and Russian guarantees. Okay? the American deep state, the blob, will never, ever, under any circumstances, buy that deal, though it would be a good deal. Go ahead, Mohammed.
A month ago, I was very optimistic about the next summit between Donald Trump and Kim Jong-un, and I thought they would achieve a breakthrough. But having reflected on Trump as a conflict analyst from my perspective, I am kind of confused, because when I consider him a pragmatist or a realist, he is not good at waging wars. And this is the second attack on Syria, and Assad may go back and use the chemical weapon once again. So there is no pragmatism in the way Trump handles his decision of going to war. At the same time, when I consider him a deal maker, I don't see him as an innovative leader who can engage in deal making. So he is everything but being a pragmatist. So now my fear is that we will witness a huge kind of a media event that pivots around the ego of Trump on the one hand and Kim on the other. And because of this ego, inflated ego politics, we may not see, or we may not witness what we are looking for, a little major or a little significance in advancing the agenda. So I think now the ball will go back to the court of the Chinese. I think if there is any balancing power between North Korea and the United States, is what Beijing can do. Otherwise, if it is left to Trump and Kim, I don't see progress coming.
I'm going to finish with Danny, and I'm going to give you a situation, Danny. You know, with the situation with the Iran deal and with North Korea, this is how it's going to be. Trump comes out and says, we want a deal. And sitting him right next to him is John Bolton. And he says to the Iranians and North Koreans, all you have to do is surrender and everything will be fine. OK, that's how it's going to play out. OK, 40 seconds to Danny. Finish up.
It's more likely that it will play out that way. But in essence, what the fundamental flaw in Trump's Syria action was, which will lead to huge problems now in the future, was setting a precedent and saying that he was going to stick by it. Because now any whiff of an idea that chemical weapons might have been used, and he will be under immense pressure internally to strike Syria again. And if he does attack Syria again, who knows the next time what kind of response will be from the Russians, from the Iranians, from the Syrians. And you've got to remember, there are US troops on the ground in Syria who, for the short part, apparently Saudi Arabian troops are going to go in now and replace them. So you've got this policy which is up in the air, but Trump has set a very dangerous precedent now in Syria.
Okay, on that point, gentlemen, we've run out of time. Many thanks to my guests in Washington, London, and in Doha. And thanks to our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time. And remember, Crosstalk rules.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.